Hello, everyone. This is Angela Glosser, your Good News On Demand volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today, I'm going to read a few articles. The first one is from the New York Times. With an orange-tufted spider hunter, birder breaks record for sightings, by Joe Tressa. And it was published on March 11, 2024. A related article will also be from the New York Times. Big Pink Bird Makes Splash in the Hamptons, by Jacob Bernstein, and it was published on June 23, 2024. Then I will read an article from the Wall Street Journal, The Crazy Economics of the World's Most Coveted Handbag, by Carol Ryan, on June 22, 2024. With an orange-tufted spider hunter, birder breaks a record for sightings. In February, Peter Kessner beat out the competition to document his 1,000th bird species. On February 9, Peter Kessner stood in the shadow of majestic Tinuian Falls on the Philippine island of Mindanao, on the cusp of a record he'd spent 7 decades chasing, and worried that he'd arrived too late. For years, nobody alive had seen and identified more bird species than Mr. Kessner. A retired American diplomat, he is birding's ultimate big lister, a star of the small but growing subculture of hyper-competitive birdwatchers who scour the globe vying to see as many species as possible. An obsessive birder since childhood, Mr. Kessner woke up that morning in February with 9,997 birds on his personal life list, more than 90% of Earth's scientifically recognized species, and 3 away from a singular milestone. But he felt hurried. A few weeks earlier, in an essay for the American Birding Association, he had outlined his plans to become the first person to document 10,000 sightings. Shortly after, new information forced him to expedite his plans. "I realized when I was writing it that I was putting a target on my back," Mr. Kessner said from his home in Cockeysville, Maryland. He didn't waste time. Mr. Kessner spent a chunk of January in Taiwan, racking up 15 new bird sightings. Soon he was in the Philippines, squeezing in an extra trip to the archipelago before another he had planned for March. Working with a local guide, Mr. Kessner needed to see 19 new birds in 7 days to reach 10,000. By mid-afternoon on February 9th, he had reached 9,999, when they heard an unfamiliar call coming from a nearby Heliconia thicket. When the bird appeared, Mr. Kessner had no doubt about what it was, an orange-tufted spider hunter, a banana-loving songbird with a sinisterly down-curved bill. Documenting the sighting with a photograph made Mr. Kessner the first birder to reach 10,000 species, a momentous achievement once considered unreachable. "The number of people that helped over the years was extraordinary," Mr. Kessner said. "Depending on the taxonomic authority, scientists generally agree that there are roughly 11,000 bird species in the world. Fewer than 60 people have ever seen 8,000. Fewer than 20 have surpassed 9,000. Only 271 bird species have ever been recorded at Central Park, a world-renowned birding destination. Only around 750 are found in the United States and Canada. Competitive birding has no official scoreboard. While many birders use photographs and field notes to provide evidence, documentation is largely based on a self-reported honor system. For many years, the preferred platform for Mr. Kessner and other big listers was surfbirds.com, before the site grew glitchy and unreliable last year. Now they use modern digital platforms like eBird and iGoTerra. further complicating matters. The number of accepted species is constantly changing, making lists like Mr. Kessler's more living organism than stone tablet. The mega listing world is small, though, so the big players often know their competition. Mr. Kessner had long considered Philip Rostron, a British birder, his biggest challenger, and Rost Gallardi, his heir apparent. But very few people in that world were aware of Jason Mann, an avid but little-known American birder living overseas who emerged as Mr. Kessner's chief competitor last year. By that point, Mr. Kessner had his sights set on 10,000, having already broken the world record set by Glaes Goran Cederlund, who died in 2020, but has been posthumously credited with 9,829 sightings. In January, Mr. Mann sent shockwaves through the listing world when he updated his total to 9,950 from 9,600, putting him just 50 birds shy of 10,000. His list immediately raised eyebrows. Included were several species either long presumed extinct or extraordinarily rare, like the New Caledonian nightjar, which had not been verifiably seen since 1939. 12 hours before Mr. Kessner found his spider hunter and announced his achievement online, Mr. Mann announced in a since-deleted news release that he had reached 10,000, prompting further and fervent online scrutiny. Because the two claims came out on the same day, it sort of went viral, said Mr. Kessner. How in the world could this happen? This thing that has never happened in the history of mankind, that two birders get 10,000 on the same day? It's crazy. The uproar deeply surprised Mr. Mann, who for 40 years had birded the world in anonymity, never identifying as a lister. He generally kept his records private since spending time online undercut the foundation of his passions, being outside. In an interview, he said that his bird list was only a fraction of the 20,000-plus species of plants, mammals, and other fauna he had digitalized, acknowledging minor errors in the upload process, but no malintent. Amid the backlash, Mr. Mann publicly recognized Kessner as the record holder and again turned his list private. He said he hoped that any recent publicity helped to support bird conservation and encouraged young people to get outdoors. I love life, human and non-human, and birds are a great lens to experience that through, Mr. Mann said. Birding brings health and positivity, building my understanding for the interconnected web of life on which we all depend. It allows me to return to family and work, recharged and with a broader perspective, like adding colors to the rainbow. Mr. Kessner began birding in Baltimore, emulating his older brother Hank, who ranks 9th in the world according to eBird. Mr. Kessner joined the Peace Corps in Zaire after graduating from Cornell University in 1976. A subsequent 36-year career in the Foreign Service shuffled him across the globe, from underbirded places like Afghanistan and Egypt to birding meccas like India and Brazil. He has seen at least one bird in 190 countries and territories recognized by eBird, including Antarctica. In 1986, he became the first person to see a representative of every bird family. He discovered a new species, the Cundinamarca antipitta, in 1989. His quest led him to some of the planet's most inaccessible places to find birds. He has navigated guerrilla-held territory in politically unstable regions in Colombia, dodged the initial Ebola outbreak in Zaire, endured near-fatal altitude sickness in Peru, thwarted car thieves in remote villages, and survived flash floods. He has been lost mountain climbing in the Solomon Islands, shipwrecked in the Amazon, and been guided through deep Papua New Guinea jungle by locals wearing human skull necklaces. "My life is almost Forrest Gumpian," Mr. Kestner said. "I've had amazing stories of near disaster, and things have sort of just worked out beautifully. I feel extremely lucky." Big Pink Bird makes splash in the Hamptons. For the last few summers in East Hampton, New York, many people have gotten up early in hopes of glimpsing Jay-Z on one of his early morning walks amid the shingled mansions of moguls such as David Zaslav, David Geffen, and Ron Perlman. But this season, the world's most successful rapper has seemingly been upstaged by a new star in town, a wild American flamingo that has drawn hundreds of spectators in recent weeks. It apparently made its way to this moneyed enclave of celebrities, plutocrats, and tourists last month, taking up residence in Georgica Pond, a brackish coastal pond that lies between East Hampton and Waynescott. First to spot the wayward bird was Kathy Blinken, an Amazon Web Services senior marketing manager who spends time on the pond with her husband, David Blinken, a first cousin to Secretary of State Anthony J. Blinken. Miss Blinken promptly called the East Hampton Star, which sent a reporter and photographer to break the story of the creature's arrival. In the coming days, those who visited Georgica Pond to see the vagrant flamingo for themselves ended up disappointed. The bird had flown. Days later, a flamingo with identical plumage was seen sunning itself roughly 200 miles away on the shores of Cape Cod Bay in Massachusetts. It seemed that the bird might be one of those high flyers who, after surveying various summer outposts of the Northeast, had determined that Cape Cod was preferable to the scenic splendor of the scene-obsessed Hamptons. But on June 9, Pietro Cioconani, an East Hampton architect, spotted the bird and made a call to the Star, which quickly published a follow-up to its scoop. Jim Colligan, an avid birder who used to serve as a councilman on nearby Shelter Island, helped spread the news of the flamingo's return. On Tuesday, he found himself riding in the car of another area resident, Steven Spielberg, to catch a glimpse of the village's principal attraction. As Mr. Spielberg drove, Mr. Colligan directed him to a sandy pathway surrounded by partridgeberry vines and onto an inlet near the end of West End Road, not far from the former home of Kelly Klein, the ex-wife of Kelvin Klein. From there, it was easy to spot the flamingo in the pond. This was less because of its distinctive plumage and more because of its stilt-like legs, which enabled it to walk the shallows with the gait of a Louboutin-clad supermodel. The flamingo went into a routine that looked like a jig. It bent its right leg, then its left, then its right again. After that, it lowered its head into the water to dig up algae and invertebrates from the floor with its hooked beak. On the other side of the pond, nearly a dozen birders stood with binoculars and cameras. More gawkers showed up as the week went on. Carrie Lyons, a day tripper from Westchester County, New York, nearly doubled over when she was informed that there was a flamingo in the pond. "Really," she said, "shut up." A birder in a Hawaiian shirt invited Miss Lyons to look through his telescope, and her doubts were replaced by questions about how on earth it had gotten there. "Did it take a wrong turn?" she asked. According to Jerry Lawrence, a marine biologist and the director of research for Audubon, Florida, the wrong turn theory is indeed plausible. In a phone interview, Mr. Lawrence said that Hurricane Idalia, which swept into Florida in August 2023, may have had something to do with the bird's arrival in the Hamptons. To escape the storm, flocks of flamingos flew north, heading to rare sightings of the brightly colored creatures in Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Most of those birds went back to where they had come from, but it is not uncommon for a flamingo to break off from a flock, either because it is disoriented or because its pals got killed, Mr. Lawrence said. A few mavericks, he noted, may simply decide to go exploring. There are examples of a flamingo hanging out by itself for years, Mr. Lawrence said, going on to tell the tale of Peaches, a flamingo who spent years living the single life at the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge in the Florida Panhandle, rejecting multiple flocks before making some friends after last year's hurricane season. Then it left with them, he said. Flamingos are found throughout the world, from tropical regions to the Andes in South America. They get their distinctive hue from the carotenoid pigments in the crustaceans and algae that make up their diet. Tough and sturdy, they can fly as fast as 40 miles per hour, according to the Bird Conservancy. They tend to make news when they escape their usual habitats. In 1964, the New York Times reported on a flamingo sighting in Niantic, Connecticut. An African flamingo had escaped a zoo in Wichita, Kansas, in 2005, was still generating headlines in 2022 when it was spotted in Port Lavaca, Texas. Pink Floyd, a flamingo that escaped an aviary in Salt Lake City, lived in the Great Salt Lake for part of each year from 1988 to 2005. The Hamptons flamingo has managed to establish friendly relations with some longtime residents of Georgica Pond, a flock of sometimes ornery swans. He gets along with them, says Lars Svanberg, a surfing instructor who was eyeing the flamingo as swans swam circles around it. They're all hanging out together. Mr. Lawrence, who has studied photos and videos of the flamingo in Georgica Pond, said it was in no immediate need of intervention from rescue groups. That's a healthy bird, he said. It's flying just fine. It's feeding just fine. Leave it alone. Now let's switch topics for a bit. The crazy economics of the world's most coveted handbag. The Hermès Birkin is one of the fashion world's most conspicuous markers of wealth. Is it worth the investment? You could double your money in 5 minutes by buying a Birkin handbag at your local Hermès boutique and then flipping it. But getting your hands on the world's most sought-after purse is a lot more complicated than it sounds. A basic black leather Birkin 25 costs $11,400 before tax at the Hermès store. Buyers can walk out and immediately give it to a handbag reseller like Privé Porté in exchange for $23,000 in cash. Privé Porté will then sell the Birkin on Instagram or its Las Vegas pop-up store, possibly on the same day, box fresh with receipt for up to $32,000. All this for a bag that analysts estimate costs Hermès around $1,000 to make. The unusual economics of the Birkin have upended the normal balance of power between shopper and store worker. At the Hermès boutique, it is the buyer who kowtows. Some of the wealthiest women in the world have brought homemade cookies to the store to cozy up to their sales assistant. They have offered tickets for Beyoncé concerts, trips to the Cannes Film Festival in a private jet, and even envelopes stuffed with cash, all to get their hands on a Birkin. Shoppers also spend tens of thousands of dollars on Hermès products they might not particularly want, such as an $87,500 canoe to be in the running for a rare purse. The Birkin turns 40 this year and is maturing into a phenomenon. To carry one is to signal that the wearer can afford to drop anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000 on a handbag. It appeals to the limelight-seeking Kardashians who own extensive collections, but also to European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde, who is often photographed on her way to meetings carrying a Birkin. The purse anchors the Hermès founding family's $150 billion fortune. But they aren't the only ones getting rich. An army of unofficial flippers all over the world profit from reselling the purse. The Birkin first hit shelves in 1984, a couple of years after the late actress Jane Birkin and Jean-Louis Dumas, then chief executive of Hermès, met on a flight to London. After complaining that she couldn't find the right size handbag, the two sketched out a design together on a drink napkin or an Air France sick bag, depending on the retelling. In return for lending her name to the new product, Hermès paid Birkin an annual royalty. The story about the bag's creation is part of its appeal, and one of the reasons why competitors have found it hard to replicate its success. "It's a great narrative," said David Dubois, associate professor of marketing at the business school in Seed. "Shoppers like the serendipity of the meeting, and that a woman who was admired for her style had a direct hand in its design." The purse didn't take off right away. During the 1990s, shoppers could walk into an Hermès boutique and buy one off the shelf. Birkins weren't reselling for more than original price tag back then. But something shifted in the years after the 2008-2009 financial crisis, according to Matthew Rubinger, now chief commercial officer at the online marketplace First Dibs, and one of the first people to recognize the Birkin's resale potential. Rock-bottom interest rates meant more money was sloshing around, and it began to find its way into alternative assets. It also became bad taste to wear a new it bag every season when the economy was on the ropes. This played to the strength of the no-logo designs like the Birkin. Rubinger established the handbag departments of both Heritage Auctions and Christie's and built them into multi-million dollar businesses. When a rare Himalaya Birkin began to set records at auction, people took notice. Once they started getting above $100,000, things got more serious, he said. Today, shoppers who want a Birkin at their Hermès store must jump through hoops. First, they need to establish a good rapport with one of the brand's sales assistants. The next step is to spend serious cash on other goods, such as silk scarves, watches, and shoes, to qualify for a bag, according to Birkin collectors. When a shipment of Birkins arrives at an Hermès store from France, the leather goods manager assigns the purses to individual sales assistants, all of whom have a list of wealthy clients waiting to be offered a bag. The sales assistant must make a case for which individual on that list deserves to be offered a Birkin and get the manager's approval. This has created a perception among Hermès shoppers that the biggest spenders get access to Birkins first. Hermès is being sued in a California court by two wounded shoppers who allege that the brand only sells Birkins to worthy customers and makes purchases of the bag conditional on buying other items at the store. Hermès said in a recent court filing that it doesn't require customers to buy other products before getting one of the coveted bags. Just how much do shoppers need to drop to be offered a bag? Birkin collectors say that there is no hard rule, but that most people can expect to shell out $10,000 or more on Hermès scarves, shoes, and clothes before they will be offered a basic Birkin. To get a rare bag like the Himalaya Birkin, they might need to spend $200,000 or more. This is known as the Hermès pre-spend, or the spend ratio in Birkin collecting circles. Hermès never spells this out explicitly, nor has it ever used these terms. But Birkin hopefuls say that they have been told by their sales assistants that they need to visit the store more often. Resellers say that Hermès sales assistants don't make commissions on Birkins, but that they can leverage hunger for the bag to sell other products to which they are rewarded. Even after spending tens of thousands of dollars, Birkin hunters might not be offered the size or color bag they want. This creates a golden opportunity for resellers. Say a woman who shops regularly with the brand wants a red Birkin, but is offered green. Rather than appearing ungrateful, because it is important to keep the sales assistant on her side in the Birkin hunting game, she will buy the bag, knowing it can be sold to a reseller for a profit, and hope to get the red later. Hermès knows its top clients are flipping the bags. Read the fine print on a Birkin receipt, and the company asks that its customers will not directly or indirectly resell Hermès products purchased in our boutiques for commercial purposes. No Hermès shopper was willing to go on the record for this article about the experience of flipping the bags to a reseller out of concern over being blacklisted by the brand. The resale market has become a kind of buy-now button for Birkin, said Michelle Burke, founder of Privé Porté. Some shoppers are willing to pay a big premium to get their hands on a Birkin immediately, in the exact color they want. They may not have the patience for the steps needed to secure one of the bags at the Hermès store. In the past, resellers recruited flight attendants or polished overseas students to buy Birkin bags in Hermès stores all over the world in return for a fee. Now the flippers get most of their supply from Hermès VIP customers. They also get Birkins by trading with their peers on WhatsApp. If clients are looking for a size or color that one seller doesn't have in stock, they can put out a call on the resellers group chat to see if anyone has that model. One way Birkin hunters can accelerate an in-store purchase is by splashing out on the brand's furniture or fine jewelry, said Judy Taylor, founder of Madison Avenue Couture and a handbag reseller for 15 years. They can pick up an $8,000 paper basket for the home office, a $70,000 gold bracelet, or a $140,000 sofa. Taylor said Hermès sales in categories like fine jewelry or watches, where the brand isn't known for an expertise, are at least partially driven by Birkin hunters. No offense to Hermès, but if you can buy a necklace from Van Cleef for the same price as Hermès, you'd likely go to Van Cleef, she said. Really big spenders are offered bespoke goods. Hermès does a sideline in special order skis, skateboards, and fishing gear for super wealthy clients, and can customize the interior of a yacht or chopper. Privé Porté's Burke received a message from a customer who was offered an $87,500 canoe. These buyers get access to the rarest Birkins. An unusually large amount of new Hermès inventory ends up for sale in the second-hand market, another sign that Birkin mania might be driving sales of products that customers don't really want. Of all the non-handbag Hermès items on the Real Real, 35% are in pristine condition, according to data supplied by the luxury resale website. The average for other designers on the Real Real, including Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Prada, Bottega Veneta, and Saint Laurent, is 20%. The Birkin's popularity is very flattering for Hermès and might also help the company to keep its marketing budget low. It doesn't need to promote itself when celebrities can be relied upon to freely splash photos of their bags on social media. In 2023, Hermès reinvested 4% of its sales back into promotions, compared with 12% at crosstown rival LVMH Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton. But the circus does cause problems for Hermès. Last year, the company had to fire staff at its Miami Design District store after some customers got more than their official allocation of Birkins, according to sources. Collector says Hermes only allows 2 bags a year per individual, but employees might have been helping shoppers to get around this. Shoppers and resellers have tried to bribe their way to Birkins. Hermes has strict rules about what customers can and can't give sales assistants as gift. Well-behaved Birkin hunters give goods that can be handed over openly at the store and shared among employees, hence the homemade cookies. Trays of baklava are another go-to. Hermes doesn't like the flipping, but stamping out the resellers would harm the brand's own interests. The company raised prices of its exotic skin Birkins by around 20% in January. Resellers think the move was aimed at squeezing profits in the secondhand market, but it hasn't worked. Dealers passed on increase to their customers without a hitch. Hermes could increase production and flood the market with new bags. This would end the financial incentive to resell Birkins, but it would also destroy their mystique. Why are women, and increasingly men too, so hungry for the Birkin? One justification for spending huge sums on a handbag is that the Birkin is a good investment. Except, it really isn't. Any profit on reselling a bag purchased in store will be lower after factoring in the thousands of dollars spent on other goods to qualify. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing these articles as much as I enjoyed finding them for you. Until next time, have a wonderful day, and thank you for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.